at our Thursday and Friday study back in the month of February, and also at one of our Thursday and Friday studies last year, the subject of church attendance was broached, and there seemed to be some interest on that subject, and it was suggested that maybe it would be a good idea to talk about that on a Lord's Day morning. And so I intend to do that this morning and possibly this afternoon as well, because I don't want to go too long this morning. It is a subject that we need to consider. There is a possibility that souls may be at stake on the issue of church attendance. Now, I think that all of us in the first place would agree that the New Testament teaches us that congregations are expected to assemble together. Hebrews 10:25 has been one of the most important and one of the most commonly mentioned passages on that subject through the years. Not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together, as the manner of some is, but exhorting one another, and so much the more as you see the day approaching. The day stressed there was probably the day of the destruction of Jerusalem. If we interpret the passage for our own time, we could consider it to be the day of the end of time, or the day of our own death. So much the more as you see the day approaching, not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together. But that's not nearly the only place that indicates in the New Testament that saints ought to assemble together. The church at Corinth, for instance, was told that they should take care of certain business, quote, when you are gathered together. 1 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 4. Other references to their assemblies are made in later chapters of the same book. For example, chapter 11, verse 20. When you come together, therefore, into one place. That makes it clear that it wasn't if you meet, but when you meet. Paul assumed that they were going to be meeting together. Chapter 14 of the same book of 1 Corinthians not only regulates the assembly of the saints, but tells what went on during the assembly of the saints. But it wasn't just at Corinth. In the city of Troas, the disciples came together on the first day of the week. Acts chapter 20, verse 7. I think we would all concur, without having to cite more and more scriptures, that according to New Testament command and example, a congregation is supposed to meet together. So I'll just leave that point because I want to get more specific about it. The specifics of attendance have to do with the relative importance of various meetings. Sunday morning, Sunday night, Wednesday night, weekend meeting like you often have in September, two-week meeting like you're planning to have this summer, and so on and so forth. What is the relative importance? What are our obligations with regard to these kinds of meetings and our attendance at them? First of all, let me say this. There's no question but what the Lord's Supper is important. The Lord's Supper that we just participated in together is of tremendous importance. But I'm not prepared to say that other assemblies of the saints are less important than the Lord's Supper assembly. I simply would not know on what scriptural grounds I could make that kind of a statement. If you would make that kind of a statement, on what scriptural grounds would you make it? Assuming that a Lord's Day morning assembly contains the Lord's Supper, on what grounds would I say that a Sunday evening meeting is less important, or maybe just half as important as Sunday morning? On what grounds would I say that a Wednesday evening meeting is only a fourth as important as a Sunday morning meeting? And not only is that true, but even if I could show that one thing is more important than another, that wouldn't prove that the lesser one was unimportant. In other words, if I could show that Sunday morning is more important than Sunday night, I still would not have shown that Sunday night is unimportant, and I still would not have shown that Sunday night is optional. So we need to be clear in our thinking about this. I think a key to this discussion is an understanding of what the church is, what the church costs, and how the church is supposed to function. We may feel disconcerted sometimes when our fellow citizens in this nation don't function nationally as we feel that they should, don't appreciate our nation as we feel that they should. Ours is a wonderful country. It has been kept free so far at a very high cost. And we try to make it better instead of disregarding it or throwing it away or taking it lightly. And we do this in part because we feel that our nation may have been providentially started by God. And that's true. I feel that way, and I know that a number of you do. Our nation is important to us, and we try to do what we can to support it. But however the origin of our nation may have come about, whether it was providentially begun by God or not, and we can't prove that it was, we can prove that the church was directly instituted by God. And it was instituted as a perfect organism. It was purchased at the awful cost of blood from God's own Son. And it's absolutely perfect, at least until we put the people in it. It's absolutely perfect. It is the body of Christ universally, and congregationally, it is the body of Christ locally. When Paul says to the Corinthians, "You are one bread and one body," he's talking about the local body of Christ assembling at Corinth. Now, it's often been pointed out that the church is not a democracy, and that is certainly true. Our nation is not technically a democracy either, although it's often said that it is, but it's not technically a democracy. Never was. The United States of America is a republic, and it's governed by a constitution and other laws rather than solely by majority vote or popular vote. But while our nation is not technically a democracy, it certainly has some democratic features to it, and all of us would acknowledge that. And I would say the same thing about the church. While the church is a monarchy, and there's no question that it's a monarchy, with the Lord governing as its king and governed by his laws, there still are some democratic features to the church. In other words, there are some things that we decide on together to come up with a way to go. And then when we've decided on those things, we ought to go that way together. Now let's consider a congregation from its beginning, because I think it makes it a lot easier for us to see the true picture, at least as I visualize it, to understand the true picture of how this is supposed to work. A congregation of saints forms when a number of Christians voluntarily band themselves together and decide to be a local body of Christ with all that that entails. They join together, understanding that there is a building where God meets with his people today, and that building is called the church. There was a time when that decision was made with regard to this congregation, for instance. It happened back in 1949. A lot of us weren't around then, but it happened in 1949. If that decision had not been made, there wouldn't be a congregation here. It has to come about in that kind of a way, a voluntary coming together of a group of Christians deciding to be organizationally a local body of Christ. 1 Corinthians 3:16 says that you, meaning the congregation collectively, are the temple of God. And Ephesians 2, verses 20 through 22 says that you are built upon the foundation of the apostles and prophets, Jesus Christ himself being the chief cornerstone, in whom all the building, fitly framed together, groweth up unto an holy temple in the Lord, in whom ye also are builded together for an habitation of God through the Spirit. God's building is the church. The church is God's temple today. 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 5 tells us that you also, as living stones or lively stones, are built up a spiritual house and holy priesthood to offer up spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God by Jesus Christ. And again in 2 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 16, you are the temple of the living God, as God hath said, I will dwell in them and walk in them, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. So we have a group of Christians coming together voluntarily and deciding to be organically and organizationally a body of Christ in the local sense. These Christians join themselves together, understanding that they need to gather with one another because of the scriptures I mentioned at the beginning of the lessons. They understand that, yes, of course, any of us can worship God privately anywhere, but we also worship God uniquely in the assembled presence of God's redeemed people. So this group of people deciding to become a local body of Christ, at some point in the discussions preceding the establishment of that congregation, the idea of assemblies is going to be broached. It has to be broached. They're not going to become a congregation and never meet. So the idea of assemblies will be broached. An assembly place will be agreed upon, and assembly times will be set. the place and times that are set should take into account the needs and the convenience and the opinions of everybody in that congregation. For example, we do not ordinarily decide to meet at 3 o'clock in the morning simply because that's not convenient for most people. That's the only time we don't meet at 3. That's the only reason we don't meet at 3 o'clock in the morning, is that that's not considered to be a convenient time for most people. Now, obviously, when we agree together to do something, we can't get our first choice about every consideration. When a group of people decides to do things a certain way, everybody is not going to get their first choice on every option. But the congregation, with its leadership, if it has one, and I hope it does have a leadership, needs to reach a considered agreement on the place to assemble and the times to assemble together. I see this agreement as a social contract and as a commitment. I would see it as a social contract and a commitment if we were talking about a board of aldermen, or even if we were talking about a chess club. I still would see it as a commitment. But I especially see it as a commitment when we're talking about the Church of the Living God that Jesus died for. It's a commitment not dissimilar to the one I make with you when you say, well, let's go out to eat, and you name a restaurant. Let's go out to eat over here at this restaurant. And I say to you, okay, let's meet there Thursday night, and we'll be there at 7 o'clock. Now, you show up at the restaurant at 7 o'clock to eat supper. If I don't show up, you wonder why. Now, if I have a reason that seems reasonable to you, you understand. Maybe I had a wreck on the way to the restaurant and I wound up in the hospital instead. But if, on the other hand, I don't show up simply because I forgot about it, then I've embarrassed myself and I've made you feel bad. If I don't show up because I simply decide, well, I'm really not hungry, and they're going to eat whether I'm there or not, and I don't like the food over there anyway, and I just don't feel like leaving home tonight, so I don't show up and I don't communicate with you that I'm not coming, then you feel wronged because I have mistreated you. I intentionally stood you up, and that's an insult. And you may go ahead and eat, but you might have a little trouble swallowing it because you wonder what's wrong. What I'm saying is this: when we as the church commit together to meet at a certain time, we ought to honor that commitment and do the best we can to meet it. And when a person outside the congregation presents himself for membership in the congregation after that congregation has already been established, then that person should be aware of the meeting times of that congregation that have been agreed upon and should understand whether or not they have an obligation to be there. Personally, I believe that each congregation with its leadership should distinguish between what I'll call assemblies of the body, where we're all expected to attend, and voluntary meetings where we have the option to attend or not to attend. Now, you may say, when I try to draw that distinction, that all the meetings of the church are voluntary because it's a voluntary organization and nobody's holding a gun to your head. And, of course, you'd be right in saying that. But I'm trying to distinguish between an assembly of the body that we're all expected to attend, or at least all obligated to attend, and some special meeting which is intended primarily for those with a certain interest or need. Let me try to draw the distinction I'm making with an example, if I can. Suppose we've got a couple of men in the congregation who become interested in studying, say, the book of Isaiah. They want to study the book of Isaiah together. And they decide, well, rather than meeting at somebody's house, we'll just meet in the basement of the meeting house because that's kind of a central location. We'll meet there one evening per week to study the book of Isaiah. And then they get the idea, why should we just only include ourselves in this? They tell the elders of the congregation, we'd like to invite anybody to join us who wants to. And the elders make an announcement or have an announcement made to that effect. These two men are planning to study the book of Isaiah together in the basement on such and such a night, and they invite any who would like to study with them to join together. That's what I'm calling a voluntary meeting. There's no onus on you to be there. There's no obligation to be there. If you decide that a study of the book of Isaiah is just not what you need right now, then there's no obligation to go. Contrast that with the opposite scenario, where the congregation has agreed to assemble as the Lord's body on a given night of the week, say a Wednesday night, and the decision then on that Wednesday night is made to study the book of Isaiah during that meeting. Now, even if you believe that a study of the book of Isaiah is just not what you need right now. You're still obligated to go, if possible, and help out the best you can, if it's regarded as an assembly of the body of Christ. Now, what am I saying here? One thing I'm saying is that we place upon each other quite an obligation when we decide to assemble as the body of Christ. I believe that we ought to be very careful about that decision and make it with all due respect to one another and with all due respect to reality. And it's an interesting thing. When congregations are being formed, they're almost always formed with a spirit of high resolve and usually a considerable degree of enthusiasm because this is a new project and people get excited about it. Suppose that this new congregation we're considering, as it's beginning to start out, this congregation we're postulating here, in its initial enthusiasm in establishing a new work, this congregation decides to meet together every night of the week. Now, we're going to meet on Sunday morning, too, and we're going to have the Lord's Supper then, but we're going to meet Sunday night at 7 o'clock. We're going to meet every night of the week at 7 o'clock, even Saturday night at 7 o'clock, because we just love each other so much. We're so enthused about this new work, and we just enjoy being together so much, and we all get along so well. We'll assemble every night. It'll be great. So they do that until the new wears off, and then they start having scheduling conflicts, and they start getting tired, and they begin to feel sort of trapped. What are they to do then? Well, the thing they need to do at that point is to discuss with one another, frankly and freely, and decide what to do. And they need to tell one another, you know, we don't have any family time anymore. We're not getting anything done at home like we used to. We don't even have enough time to prepare the lessons that we're presenting here every night. Supper is always rushed, and it's just not working out. Everyone ought to feel during that discussion that they can give their opinion without being regarded as less spiritual than anybody else. They need to discuss together and decide together on a revision of their schedule as a congregation, pacing themselves for the sake of survival. And what they as a congregation decide, they're obligated to do to the best of their ability. It's all too easy to plan assemblies and all too difficult to fill those assemblies with something worthwhile. A well-prepared, well-organized, well-ordered, well-executed meeting is a joy to attend, but far too often our assemblies are different from that. How often have we wasted one another's time and bred resentment in the process? You know, my grandpa used to fascinate me with the way he would call his hogs when it was time for them to be fed. He'd go out in the lot, and the hogs could be way off. Some alfalfa or hayfield would be way off somewhere, trying to find something to eat over there. And he'd just stand there by the trough and yell out to them, "Suey! Suey!" And those little pork legs would start moving from wherever they were. They'd come from every direction to that trough. And they didn't wait for each other when they got there. It was a joy to behold. And as a little boy, I was fascinated at that process. And I remember several times trying to get my grandpa to call those hogs. But I never could get him to call the hogs unless he had put some food in the trough. He wouldn't call them to an empty trough because he knew if you call your hogs to an empty trough too often, then they won't come anymore. He had that much respect for his hogs that he wouldn't fool them. And I have had occasion in adulthood to wonder if my grandpa had more respect for his hogs than the brethren have for one another. Because sometimes we'll call one another into an assembly, and sometimes we're calling to an empty trough. Sometimes we're calling God's sheep to a meal that's so stinking unpalatable, it just defies description. It's worse than nothing. I'm not pleading for perfection. We'll never have that. You certainly don't have it with me. I'm not pleading for eloquence. That's been way, way overrated in the church through the years. But I am pleading for our mutual edification to be not only mutual, but edification. Just a little cogency goes a long way sometimes. You know, I have sat in classes where you couldn't even tell. I couldn't even tell what it was supposed to be about until we were a half hour into it. And I'm not exaggerating, and I was trying. These things ought not so to be. I'm not asking for anything that the brethren cannot do. We can do better. If I thought we couldn't do any better, then I wouldn't be so hard on us. But I know in many cases we could do a lot better. But it's easier not to. And sometimes I'm afraid that we get a kind of a good old boys mentality or a clubhouse mentality, whatever you want to call it, that where we sort of mutually and tacitly agree together to excuse each other on these things in our lack of preparation. I speak to our shame. It's hard to prepare to the degree that the result is helpful to the church. That's hard. But hard preparation makes for easy understanding. And the question becomes, if you are participating, are you willing to lay down your life for the brethren? Are you willing to pull out the stops and do what it takes to have something worthwhile to present? Easy preparation makes for difficult understanding and confusion and muddled thinking. And our class may become a pooling of ignorance and nothing more than that. And anybody who really sacrificed to be there may feel cheated or angry or resentful or frustrated. And what is their recourse? We have obligated one another to assemble together. And what is their recourse? They're committed. They want to do right. But they're frustrated and maybe a little resentful. Because when you participate publicly, you have a solemn obligation to prepare yourself ahead of time and do the job to the best of the ability that God has given you. Upon whom much is given, of him shall much be required. And God knows when you don't give it your best. We only answer to each other secondarily on this kind of an issue. Primarily, we answer to God. Everybody in the family of God picks their own level of involvement, and we will individually answer to God on this issue. You may be discouraging somebody who's trying hard to fulfill their obligations. And shoddy workmanship is contagious. If I see you get by with it, I may be tempted to get by with it myself because it's just so much easier. So much easier. Sermon preparation is just really hard, I think. It's excruciatingly difficult. It's like pulling teeth. It reminds me of that statement that Ernest Hemingway made one time about when he wrote The Old Man and the Sea. He said he rewrote one sentence in there 26 times. Well, that's agonizing. It's excruciating. It's very difficult in teaching the Bible to prepare something that's not so glaringly obvious that you just bore people to death. And what a crime it is to bore people with the Bible. If we are consistently telling ourselves that we just don't have time to prepare, then we're either having too many meetings or we're not using our time to optimum advantage. Now, since we do have a time to start and a time to stop, I think I'd better stop at this point, but this is only half of my lesson. After we eat together, I want to give you the other half, and some of it is going to go in a little different direction from what I was just saying so far. I hate to break at this point, but out of consideration for our closing time, I'm going to do that. I hope that you will be with us here this afternoon. We're going to conclude this morning by extending the Lord's invitation to come unto him in simple trusting faith and be a child of God. If you have never obeyed him in primary obedience and would join with the army of God, we invite you to do that.